Welcome to another evening at the Emory Center for Christian Studies. Before I introduce our speaker tonight, I wanted to give you a little preview of some upcoming events. Next week, we have an Andreas Forum, led by Stephen Broyles, and the topic is the Scribes and the Book of Revelation. How do you copy a book full of bad grammar? The following Friday, December 7th, we have Bruce Herman from Gordon College, and his topic is Beautiful Eye People, iPod, Pop Culture, and Genuine Beauty. And the final event of this semester is going to be on Friday, December 14th, and that's another Andreas Forum, and it's Raising Voices, Gregorian Chant to Bach. Well, it's my pleasure tonight to introduce Matt Dickerson. Matt is a professor at Middlebury College, Vermont, in both the programs of Environmental Studies and Department of Computer Science. He's also the director of the New England Young Writers Conference at Breadloaf and the Vermont Conference on Christianity and the Arts. He's the author of several books, including three titles exploring the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, Following Gandalf, Epic Battles and Moral Victory in the Lord of the Rings from Brazos Press, From Homer to Harry Potter, A Handbook on Myth and Fantasy, also from Brazos, and most recently, Ents, Elves, and Eriador, The Environmental Vision of J.R.R. Tolkien from University Press of Kentucky. As of the summer of 2007, Matt has also caught trout in two continents, three Canadian provinces, four countries, and 20 different U.S. states, including, most surprisingly, Delaware. Please join me in welcoming Matt Dickerson.
Well, thank you all for coming. I'm just curious, before I start, to just have a sense for who's here and what you're here for. How many of you have read The Hobbit?
This year?
Within the last 24 hours. How many of you have read The Lord of the Rings? Wow, that's a good, a knowledgeable audience. The Silmarillion? Okay, that's so there'll be the every once in a while you'll get the kind of the brilliant little side insight, brilliant because of Tolkien, not because of me. Little side insights. How many of you have seen the movies? How many of you have seen the movies and not read the books and are willing to admit it? Raise those hands a little higher. Could you get pictures, please? And just all right. Well, are you getting my pictures? So one little disclaimer. Or apology, perhaps. I'm not sure which. I really don't like computers a whole lot, despite having a PhD in computer science. And I really dislike PowerPoint. I especially dislike bullet items. So in fact, the only reason I'm having this here is, from here, for after my cover slide, the only reason I'm using this is to project some quotations, mostly from Tolkien, because I want to explore Tolkien's text, and I want you to see what he had to say. That's far more important than to hear what I have to say about Tolkien. So I want you to understand Tolkien, and to take a look at his writing, his text, his ideas, and I kind of want to lead you through some observations about his work. And particularly when we're looking at sort of important words or subtle points, I find it just very helpful to be able to see them and read them on your own, rather than just to hear me read them aloud to you. So from here on in, every other slide is just passages we're going to look at together. And I promise you, no bullet items. If a slide of bullet items, an outline of my talk appears at any point, you can sort of stand up, boo, walk out, or throw things at me. The main thing I want to do is I just want to make some observations about what I'm calling three faces of evil. I want to look at how Tolkien portrayed evil. Or in particular, how he portrayed the effects of evil. What does evil do? Which may seem an odd topic, but I think indirectly when you look at how evil is portrayed, we also get good insights into what he thought of was good. And I think by looking at how he portrays evil, we'll get some tremendous insights into his understanding of what good ecology is, which is to say, how should we relate to the earth on which we live? What are the good practices, the healthy practices? What's his image of health in particular, with respect to how we live on this earth, with how we interact or treat the earth, with our relationships with the creation around us. I just want to look at some observations. At the end, we don't have a whole lot of sort of time after this, but at the end, I will try to explicitly talk about where this came from and why it's important. But most of the talk is just going to be observing what he wrote about evil or how he portrayed evil in The Lord of the Rings. And then a little bit at the end, we'll come back and explicitly talk about the roots of that and why this is, in particular, a Christian ecology that we're looking at. This is a very small part, and I want to give credit to my co-author, Jonathan Evans, from the University of Georgia. We wrote this book together. The idea of the book was originally mine. I invited him to co-write it with me, and he resisted for about a year, and I finally got him excited enough to write it with me. And by the end, it was no longer clear whose original ideas were which is the way co-writing a book should work. So certainly, if there's good ideas that I share with you tonight, there is likely to have been Jonathan Evans as they were mine. So I'd like to give him credit. And I guess the only other thing I'd say is that this is just a tiny, tiny part of Tolkien's ecology. This is sort of one part of one out of about 10 chapters in the book. So if you find it an interesting exploration of Tolkien's ecology, I'll get commercial and you can go find my very expensive hardcover book in a local library. So let's begin. The first face, what I'm calling the first face of evil, is evil in its most extreme form. It's the view that we see of Mordor in The Lord of the Rings. Mordor is the home of Sauron. Mordor is where Frodo and Sam need to go to bring the ring to destroy the ring. So it's our glimpse of the most extreme picture of evil in Middle-earth, or in the third age of Middle-earth, in which the story takes place. And let's read this. Let me read this to you. You can follow along on the screen. It's a pretty amazing description. This is the first glimpse they get into sort of the front door of Mordor. They just come through the Dead Marshes, and they're looking down at the front door of Mordor. Dreadful as the Dead Marshes had been, and the arid moors of the no-man lands, more loathsome far was the country that the crawling day now slowly unveiled to his shrinking eyes. Even to the mirror of dead faces, some haggard phantom of green spring would come, but here neither spring nor summer would ever come again. Here nothing lived, not even the leprous growths that feed on rottenness. The gasping pools were choked with ash and crawling muds, sickly white and gray, as if the mountains had vomited the filth of their entrails upon the lands about. High mounds of crushed and powdered rock, great cones of earth, fire-blasted and poison-stained, stood like an obscene graveyard in endless rows, slowly revealed in the reluctant light. They had come to the desolation that lay before Mordor, the lasting monument to the dark labor of its slaves that should endure when all their purposes were made void, a land defiled, diseased beyond all healing, unless the great seas should enter in and wash it with oblivion. "I feel sick," said Sam. Frodo did not speak. So first, just look. Observe that the first glimpse we get of the evil of Mordor is a description of what evil does to the land. And that's the dominant theme through the first sort of 70% of this talk. As we look at the three faces of evil, the important thing I want you to note is evil is described by what it does to the earth. And that alone is really important and worth noting. That evil is recognized by its effect on nature, on creation, on the land. We can recognize evil by what it does to the earth. Look at the extremes and the words that are used just in this one passage. It's described as vomit, as the entrails of the earth. It's gasping. It is sickly. It is obscene. And just, since Tolkien was a philologist who loved words, and he used words carefully, Remember that the word obscene is a word that has moral connotations. The word obscene means morally offensive. So even that use of the word suggests that what was done to the earth is morally wrong. First glimpse that we can morally wrong not only other humans, but we can morally wrong the earth itself, Tolkien is saying. What was done here was obscene. It's an obscenity. Even this word loathsome means hated or loathed. Oh, in fact, I promised in our dinner discussion before we began, our sitting around the dinner table drinking tea and coffee, I promised a little philology that when the opportunity came. So here's my first break from what I wanted to say for those interested. Where is the other person interested in philology? When Gandalf first comes to Rohan, and he comes before King Théoden, who at that point is sort of under the spell of Saruman, and Wormtongue, that the sort of the evil person who's helped to corrupt King Théoden, calls Gandalf Laith Spell. And laith spell comes from two old English words. Laith, or loathsome, it would be the modern derivative. So lathe is the old English form of the modern English form, loathe, meaning hated, or evil, or ill. So, and a spell in old English is a story. So, or news. So laith spell would mean hateful news. Loathed news. So he calls Gandalf hated news, or hated story, or hated messenger. What's really interesting about this is when missionaries came to England and brought the gospel, the what? They brought the what? The good news. The evangelium, or the euangelium, the good message. They needed a word in English to translate good message, evangelium, into. So they use the old English good spell, good story, good news, good message. So the God spell, the good spell, is the good message, the good news. So when Wormtongue calls Gandalf loath spell, he's saying you are the opposite of the gospel. So it's a real insult indeed. This is the same word that Tolkien's using here to describe what happens to the land. It is loathed. Notice also, I think it's hard to miss that the imagery here is of industrialization, right? The mounds of slag, the crushed powdered rock reminds us of strip mining. And of course, the poison-stained earth is warfare. So the imagery he's drawing here also is from industrialization, the ravages of, say, unhealthy mining, and warfare. And particularly, the type of industrialization that seems to run roughshod and rampant over the landscape, such as pastures, farmlands, and undisturbed wilderness, sort of before a retreating enemy. It's a warfare image. So again, some observations. Let me give you five. One, it's the land itself which is defiled and diseased, and the land can be sinned against. So a land can be morally wronged. We not only can we morally wrong others, but we can morally wrong the land itself. Two, land can be diseased, and there is a concern for the health of the land. Tolkien is concerned not only for the health of the characters who live in the land, but the health of the land itself. Three, our health depends on the health of the land. What is the first thing that's said after this description? I feel sick. When we make the land sick, it makes us sick. Fourth, there's a very interesting reference here. It will remain horrible. It will be a monument to the dark labor of its slaves that it should endure unless the great sea should enter in and wash it with oblivion. Well, the direct reference here is to a historical event in Middle-earth, which is the downfall of Numenor, which those of you who have read the Silmarillion are aware of. When the great wave comes up, it's Tolkien's Tolkien's story of Atlantis, his lost Atlantis story. When the great waves, the great flood comes in and wipes out the evil of Numenor, that's Aragorn's people who had fallen. But of course, it should also point to the great flood, to Noah's story, which comes in to wash out the sin of humankind. So in other words, their association is of the destruction of the land is with human sin. And the solution points to Noah's story. And finally, it is a monument. And that suggests, again, that the destruction of the earth, the destruction of nature, or the destruction of creation is central to evil. That a blasted landscape is a monument to evil suggests that that's precisely what evil wants to do. Evil wants to destroy the land. That's at the heart of what evil represents. It's not only after us, it's after the land itself. And we often forget that. Feel free, by the way, at any point to stop if you have questions or observations. Now, this is just the front door of Mordor. The closer we get to Mordor, the worse it gets. Now, fortunately, in the story at this point, the hobbits decide not to enter the front door. They get a little reprieve. They move out through the land of Ithilien, which still has some health. And then they go further south, and they come back closer to Mordor again. And as they enter the land, the closer in they get, the deeper in they get, the worse it gets. And let me just give you one other description of Mordor. On the very edge of the last fence of Mordor, the inner plain stretching away into a formless gloom, only a gray light came to the dreary fields of Gorgoroth. Their smokes trailed on the earth and lay in the hollows, and fumes leaked from fissures in the earth. Between them and the smoking mountain and about it, north and south, all seemed ruinous and dead, a desert burned and choked. They wondered how the lord of this realm maintained and fed his slaves and his armies. So again, just a couple more comments. I think thinking Tolkien's time, thinking of how he not only watched his beloved English countryside ravaged by the industrialization of the late 19th and early 20th century, he also spent several months on the battlefield, in the Battle of Somme, and watched the ravages of war on the landscape. So we see, again, the images of industrialization. The mountain is I think, represents nothing so clearly as a big smokestack, belching fumes into the air. And the fumes are even coming from the ground. Yes?
I remember reading it. What year was it published? I remember my sister bringing it.
I think 55, 56, and 57.
I remember reading it in like Night Cray and wondering whether he was talking about the atomic bomb.
The concept of the ring was pretty well set in his mind before the atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So it was published in 55, 56, and 57, but it was actually finished about 4 years before that, and it was delayed because of post-World War II paper shortages. It's such a long book, it was going to take a lot of paper to publish it. So it was actually done in the early 50s, but a lot of the storyline was done before he knew anything. In fact, Tolkien, in one of his letters, comments, he said, if I had been writing about the atomic bomb, it would have had a different ending. So he wasn't even writing at that point about the ravages of the atomic bomb. He says he thought through if he rewrote it with kind of the atomic bomb in mind, and the ring is an image of the atomic bomb. He actually had a different ending that he would have used. This is a side note that there's no time to explore, but I'm just going to point you to it. Any Wendell Berry fans out there? Wonderful. So I love Wendell Berry, and I've been reading a lot of Wendell Berry lately, and You know, one of the things he writes a lot about is the unhealthiness of agribusiness and the healthiness of agrarianism. And one of the hallmarks of agribusiness is that land is not worked by people with a long-term stake in its health. And he says land has to be worked by people with a long-term stake in its health. And food ought to be eaten, at least in part, by people who have a long-term stake in the health of the land on which that food is grown. Tolkien, and we're going to come back to this at the end when we look at the third face of evil, but we actually begin to get a hint that the agriculture of evil is agribusiness. It's not agrarianism. And in fact, one of the things you get a hint of here is in the next paragraph, which I'm not going to quote, they wondered how the lord of the realm maintained and fed his slaves and his armies. The next paragraph, which I'm not going to read, goes on to describe how, in fact, he had slave-run farm fields somewhere far away. So Mordor is associated with slave agriculture.
And outsourcing.
What?
And outsourcing.
And outsourcing, correct. Yeah, food for export. And we'll come back to this. Outsourcing of labor and large long distance shipment of food. So the labor's outsourced and the food's shipped long distances. But here's the point. The destruction of the earth is not morally neutral. Down on the stones behind the fences of the Blackland, the air seemed almost dead, chill and yet stifling. For the hobbits, each day, each mile was more bitter than the one before as their strength lessened and the land became more evil. So the destruction of the earth here is not seen as morally neutral. There's an objective value judgment here. It is evil to destroy the land, and again, it is also harmful to humans. When we destroy the earth, we also harm our fellow humans. So as a side note, you know, one of the things I would point out to Christians who claim that Christians need not be concerned with care of the earth, with environmental issues, I would point out that even if you couldn't care less about the earth that God made, you should care so deeply about your fellow humans that that alone should be enough motivation that we should be good caretakers of the earth. Even if we wrongfully dismissed the value of creation, we should still be called to nurturing of the earth for no other reason than those who suffer the most from the degradation of the soil are the most poor and the most impoverished and the most oppressed in the world that we live in. Now, here's the point, though. How many of you have spent a lot of time in a landscape like this? That's what I figured. It's pretty extreme, isn't it? And as an extreme landscape, it's actually pretty easy for us to dismiss. It's so extreme that we can all say, well, that's really evil, but we don't do anything like that. Nothing like that happens around us. So he gives this really extreme picture, and I would argue, by the way, that this extreme picture is realistic. There are plenty of places on the earth, and you know, think Superfund site, for example, that are this bad. But most of us don't see it. In fact, Tolkien acknowledges, even in the story, when Merry and Pippin are going to Treebeard and essentially asking Treebeard and the Ents for help, Treebeard says, quote, Mordor is a long way away, end quote. So even in Middle Earth, the Ents are a little bit slow to fight against Mordor because it's a long way away. It's a lot further away for us. So it's easy to say, yeah, this is a really horrible picture, but we don't really have to deal with it. And so Tolkien gives us a second face of evil. He brings it a little bit closer to us. The second face of evil is what we see in Isengard, in Saruman, and in the rhetoric of progress. And let's begin actually not with the environmental picture, but with Saruman's words. Here's a speech that one of the things that the film did get right is this speech. They included it almost verbatim. So whatever faults, a lot of faults in the films, this that they did a good job with this. A new power is rising. Against it, the old allies and policies, this is Saruman speaking, the old allies and policies will not avail us at all. There is no hope left in elves or dying Numenor. This, then, is one choice before you, before us. We may join with that power. It would be wise, Gandalf. There is hope that way. Its victory is at hand, and there will be rich reward for those that aided it. As the power grows, its proved friends will also grow, and the wise, such as you and I. May with patience come at last to direct its course, to control it. We can bide our time. We can keep our thoughts in our hearts, deploring maybe evils done by the way, but approving the high and ultimate purpose, knowledge, rule, order, all the things we have so far striven in vain to accomplish, hindered rather than helped by our weak and idle friends. Now, Saruman has no face. He has no voice. He's difficult for us to imagine. And we're not, in some way, we're not even supposed to be able to imagine him. He's unreal to our modern imagination. And so he remains a horrible evil, but a distant evil. And Mordor, too extreme to really touch us. But Saruman, by contrast, has a face. He has a voice. And it's, in fact, a very rational voice. I think it ought to be a very familiar voice to us. For example, he calls for a high and ultimate purpose. He's not calling for Gandalf to go out and, you know, sell drugs to children in junior high. He's calling for good things here. He's saying a high and ultimate purpose. He's calling for knowledge and order. Aren't these good things? No? Don't we think knowledge is good? Don't we think order is good? He calls for rule. Now, maybe in the wrong context, you can have a negative connotation to rule. But remember, the opposite of rule is anarchy, right? So I think even rule we can see as a good thing. He calls for wisdom and he calls for hope. So he's calling to knowledge, order, rule, wisdom, and hope. These are good things that he's calling us towards. He's providing rational arguments for Gandalf. In fact, he gives Gandalf two rational arguments why Gandalf should follow along with him. Very rational, very reasonable arguments. One, follow me, follow along and you'll get a reward. Is that an effective argument today? Darn right it is. You know, what percentage of people around us are not motivated by this argument? And what's the second argument?
And we'll be able to control it
afterwards. Yeah. In other words, our means may not seem all that good, but in the end, we'll get something good out of it. We may have to do some evil along the way, but our ultimate end will be good for everybody. So it's a very rational voice, and it's a modern voice. And I think we've heard these arguments before, and people have followed them. People continue to follow these arguments. We make compromises for the sake of some future good. But what does it lead to? Now let's look at the description of Isengard. Look at what happens to Isengard when you follow Saruman's rhetoric. Gandalf's first description is very simple. He said, it once was green and fair, now it's full of pits and forges. Pits and forges, there's that industrialization again. No trees grew there, but among the rank grasses. It's not as bad as Mordor, is it? It still has grass. The grass may be rank, but it still has grass. Among it, rank grasses could still be seen. The burned and axe-hewn stumps of ancient groves. Instead of trees, there marched long lines of pillars, some of marble, some of copper and iron, joined by heavy chains. Well, it's, you know, it's not necessarily bad. I can think of some beautiful marble buildings. Middlebury College has a few. They're very nice. It's not such a horrible image all in of itself. Certainly better than Mordor. But it is a bad picture, isn't it? Iron wheels revolved there endlessly, and hammers thudded. At night, plumes of vapor steamed from the vents, lit from beneath with red light or blue or venomous green. And then we get this repeated refrain. He says again, once it had been fair and green, it was not so now. This is a different quote, by the way. He says, once it had been green and fair, now it's pits and forges. Then later, once it had been fair and green, it was not so now. And almost the next breath, once it had been green and filled with avenues and groves of fruitful trees, watered by streams that flowed from the mountains to a lake. But no green thing grew there in the latter days of Saruman. It's a very clear image. From green to not green. From green and fair to not green and fair. And this is one of the most potent images, because we still have the memory of what it once was. With Mordor, that memory is gone. It's so extreme, no one even knows how beautiful Mordor once was. But here, that memory still exists. And so it's an even more poignant second face of evil. And it's tied to a very rational argument on Saruman's part. And, of course, the kind of the final line, it was a sad country. A couple other things that are pointed out here, which I won't quote, but it's also very clear that it's a place of war, that it's a place where Saruman is raising armies and training armies for warfare. It's interesting just to note what Treebeard, the Ent, the protector of nature, says about Saruman. And at the end, one of the most interesting etymologies or philological points I could make is has to do with the word Ent, but it would take probably 10 minutes. So if you're interested in philology at the end, ask me where the name or the word Ent comes from. It will involve Latin, Old Dutch, Old Norse, and Old English in answering the question. Treebeard says, Saruman is plotting to become a power. He has a mind of metal and wheels, and he does not care for growing things, except as far as they serve him for the moment. Okay. The value of things is dependent on their usefulness to him. So he has a utilitarian understanding of the world. He does not see the world as inherently good, good in and of itself as having value. Its only value comes from its usefulness to him. Do you know any time you talk about the world as a natural resource, you're falling into Saruman speak? How often do we speak of natural resources? I think one of the Christian ecologists that I respect a lot is Cal DeWitt, who helped found the Sable Institute of Environmental Studies in northern Michigan, and he teaches environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin. And he does research on peat bogs in Wisconsin. And so some of these peat bogs, I think, you know, get over 100 feet deep of peat. And one of the things you can do with peat is you can take core samples. You can go down 100 or a couple hundred feet down and take, basically, you know, just stick a big tube down into the peat and pull the tube up, and you've got 120 feet of peat, and they know how old it is at each depth. You know, you go down 20 feet, you're 100,000 years old, and, you know, 40 feet, and you're 200,000 years old. And as you go down, you can look at the chemical composition of the peat, and you can discover what was in the atmosphere at that time. Because the peat absorbs chemicals out of the atmosphere. And what he discovered is in fact that amazing fact. It is not even so important exactly what the peat absorbs, is that it does absorb. Peat turns out to be this incredible natural processor of toxic gases, greenhouse gases in the environment, which are naturally there. Every time a volcano explodes, every time there's a huge forest fire, there's things naturally dumped into the atmosphere that would be what we would call today greenhouse gases. Peat does this wonderful job of absorbing all this carbon out of the atmosphere, as well as other things. What happens to peat over long geological eras as it gets compressed down? It turns into coal. What do we do with coal? Coal is a natural resource. And we burn coal. Where did the coal come from? It came from peat. So in the matter of a few minutes, we can release back into the environment what the peat spent 100,000 years sucking out for us. And it's going to take another 100,000 years for the peat to pull that out. Now, what if we just stopped and said, was this world created by a God who had a purpose? Did he have a purpose for that peat? What is coal? What is peat? Where did it come from? And if instead of viewing the earth as a natural resource to be used by us, we ask, what's its purpose? What's it there for? Who created it? Even to begin with the notion of looking at it as creation, we're going to begin to ask different sets of questions. That doesn't necessarily mean we're not going to burn coal for fuel. But we'd at least beginning to be asking the right questions. When you view it merely as a natural resource, you're doing Saruman speak. he's not that far off. He's a very modern voice. The destruction of forests for utilitarian purposes, it is orc work, Treebeard goes on to say. The wanton hewing without even the bad excuse of feeding the fire that had so angered us. The treachery of a neighbor who should have helped us. There is no curse in Elvish, Entish, or the tongues of men bad enough for such treachery. Down with Saruman. He and his foul folk are making havoc now. Down on the borders they are felling trees. Good trees. Some of the trees they just cut down and leave to rot. Orc mischief, that. But most are hewn up and carried off to feed the fires of Orthanc. There is always a smoke rising from Isengard these days. There are wastes of stump and bramble where once there were singing groves. So first of all, this is not Saruman's land. This is the land adjacent to Saruman's land. So one observation, a bad steward of one's own land will almost certainly be a bad steward of someone else's land. If Saruman takes lousy care of Isengard, he's definitely not going to take good care of the neighboring Fanghorn Forest. The ill effects spill over into the surrounding lands. See, you treat your own land horribly, you're affecting everybody else. It spills out. It spills over. Second, it's about power. Right? Exploitation is ultimately about power. And that's what Saruman has described, that he's an exploiter. And it, by the way, if you exploit people, you exploit the land. If you exploit the land, you will exploit other people. Don't think that our characters are so, you know, compartmentalized that we can practice exploitation in 70% of our lives and be perfectly wonderful people in the other 30%. If you're an exploiter of the earth, you are going to be exploiting other people as well. And finally, again, when he says there's no curse bad enough for such treachery, again, notice that this is a moral judgment. What Saruman is doing is not merely inconvenient or uncomfortable or unhappy, but it's evil. To destroy the land, Tolkien is saying, is evil. And it's deserving of punishment. So let me jump a moment. I want to look at Tom Shippey, one of the great Tolkien scholars of the past decade. People say, what's the second best book you could read to really understand Tolkien? I'd say the second best book you could read to really understand Tolkien is Following Gandalf. The best book you could read to understand Tolkien, I'm sad to say, is probably Tom Shippey's Author of the Century. So if you're really only going to buy one, get his. If you're going to buy two, you know, get this, too. Tom Shippey writes, Saruman had slowly shaped Isengard to his shifting purposes and made it better as he thought, being deceived for all those arts and subtle devices for which he forsook his former wisdom, and which finally he imagined were his own, came from Mordor. So that what he made was not only a little copy, a child's model or a slave's flattery of that vast fortress, armory, prison, furnace of great power, Barad-dûr, the Dark Tower. In other words, this really is a second face of evil. This is not a different evil. That's the point. When I say the second face of evil, I mean this is just another face of Mordor. A little more recognizable to us, but the same thing. And Tolkien, I think, makes that clear.
For some reason, that didn't show up on the screen. Oh,
I did. There we go. How's that? And now, having shown that to you, let me continue the Shippey quote. The applicability of this is obvious, with Saruman becoming an image of one of the characteristic vices of modernity, though we still have no name for it. A kind of restless ingenuity, skill without purpose, bulldozing for the sake of change. Think of, where's our Wendell Berry fan? Think of Troy in Jaber Crow. A kind of restless ingenuity, skill without purpose, bulldozing for the sake of change. The Sarumans of the real world rule by deluding their followers with images of a technological paradise in the future, a modernist utopia. But what one often gets are the blasted landscapes of Eastern Europe, strip mined, polluted, and even radioactive. One may disagree with Tolkien's diagnosis of the situation and with his nostalgic or pastoral solution to it, but there can be no doubt that he has at least addressed a serious issue and tried to give it both a historic and a psychological dimension nearly always missing elsewhere. Saruman, indeed, talks exactly like too many politicians. It is impossible to work out exactly what he means because of the abstract nature of his speech. His message is, in any case, one of compromise and calculation. And I want to just jump one more slide before we jump to the third face, which I mislabeled as face number two again, but we'll get there. Another really wonderful writer is Norman Wirzba, and he's an environmental philosopher at Georgetown College in Kentucky. And he writes about this rhetoric. He is not a Tolkien fan. I mean, he hasn't disliked Tolkien. He simply never read Tolkien. But when I read this passage of his, I thought he easily could have been describing Saruman. The purveyors of the industrial and now information and global economies routinely claim the inevitability and necessity of their programs. Right? Think of Saruman saying, this new power has come. There's nothing we can do to stop it. It's inevitable. And then they argue that the agrarian ways are anachronistic, even dangerous, since they stand in the way of a bright future. Our friends have hindered rather than helped us, Saruman says. History shows, however, that the prophets and salespeople of technological progress rarely reveal the whole story. Tolkien made this same environmental point 50 years before Norman Wirzba did, in the form of a story. David Orr simply writes, industrialization rests on the simple and seductively powerful idea that we can exploit soils, forests, biological diversity, and minerals without adverse consequences, and that doing so is akin to our rightful destiny. That idea is widely known to be wrong, even pervasive, perversely so, but it still exerts a powerful hold on the public mind and public policies. The third face, called it two again, but I can count. The third face, where Tolkien really brings it home, is back in the Shire. The scouring of the Shire, rather than being a tack on, rather than being a little anticlimactic passage at the end of The Lord of the Rings, which filmmakers are free to leave out if they don't have time, is in fact the most important passage in the book. Tolkien, I think, would argue vehemently or adamantly that the scouring of the Shire is what it's all about. See, the hobbits are an anachronism. They don't belong in Middle-earth, and they are an accident. When Tolkien began writing The Hobbit, he had at that point spent 20 years writing his Middle-earth Legendarium. His Middle-earth Legendarium, the earliest surviving manuscripts date to 1916. Letters indicate that he was working on these stories as early as 1914. So 20 years before he began writing The Hobbit, he was working on his stories of Middle-earth. And he loved them, and they were profoundly important to them. Some of the stories which he began in 1914, which wouldn't get published until 4 years after he died. When he began writing The Hobbit, I think he had no idea that that story belonged in Middle-earth. He's writing a children's story. And almost by accident, he sort of partway through the story stumbles into Middle-earth. When the hobbits hit Rivendell and they meet Elrond, all of a sudden, Tolkien said, oh, this story isn't taking place in a brand new world, it's taking place in Middle-earth. And from that point on, he can begin to touch with the history of Middle-earth. But the point is that the hobbits don't belong in Middle-earth. They're 19th century Englishmen. They have umbrellas and friction matches. They don't belong in Middle-earth. And I'll tell you who else doesn't belong in Middle-earth. Tom Burton Bill. You know who Tom Burton Bill are?
Trolls.
The trolls. Yeah. They're entirely inappropriate villains for Middle-earth. And you know what's even worse? Gandalf says, when Gandalf comes back to rescue them from the trolls, he said, well, the folk of Elrond were hurrying away for fear of the trolls. Yeah. Well, I'll guarantee you that the folk of Elrond would not have been running from Tom Burton Bill. Glorfindel stands up to nine Nazgul and chases them away. He would not have been running from Tom, Bert, and Bill. Because Tolkien had no idea when he started writing The Hobbit that this was part of Middle-earth. But this is the beauty, you see. Because this is an accidental anachronism. Tolkien takes the hobbits and they accidentally appear in Middle-earth, and you have this 19th or early 20th century person in a heroic setting that demands their heroism. And so they become our eyes. Hobbits are what enable us to see what we're supposed to see in Tolkien's stories. Which is why every important battle in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, except for one, every battle but one is seen from the eyes of the hobbit. And there's no glorification of warfare. None of the violent blood and guts is described. You know what happens when battles begin? Tolkien will suddenly shift the perspective out of the battlefield and back to the eyes of some distant hobbit sitting on the walls of Minas Tirith. Or in the case of the end of The Hobbit or the end of The Lord of the Rings, the hobbit gets knocked unconscious and isn't even there to witness the battle. Tolkien doesn't describe the battle. He doesn't glorify the war. He shows you the war through the eyes of the hobbits. And we see them as horrible, terrible places where heroism happens. So the hobbits are our eyes. So when the evil brings us back to the Shire, that's when we get the picture as we are able to understand it. The hobbits are our eyes for seeing Middle-earth. So at the end of the story, when the hobbits are returning to the Shire, and they find out Gandalf's not coming, they're aghast. They say, you know, aren't you coming with us? And Gandalf says, you know what he says? You don't need me now. You're all grown up. And he says, this is what you have been trained for. That's his words. This is what you have been trained for. You don't need me now. And that's Tolkien, I believe, speaking to his readers. The point of the story was to train you to go back to your world and to live this out. So what we see in the Shire is what we're supposed to bring out of this. And here's what the hobbits see when they come back. There, they had their first really painful shock. This was Frodo and Sam's own country. They found out now that they cared about it more than any other place in the world. Many of the houses that they had known were missing. Some seemed to have been burned down. The pleasant row of old hobbit holes in the bank of the north side of the pool were deserted, and their little gardens that used to run down bright to the water's edge were rank with weeds. Worse, there was a whole line of ugly new houses all along poolside. Where the hobbit and road ran close to the bank, an avenue of trees had stood there. They were all gone. And looking up with dismay up the road towards the back end, they saw a tall chimney of brick in the distance. It was pouring out black smoke into the evening air. If your imagination can't put you into either Saruman's Isengard or Sauron's Mordor, we all have been to this scene. This brings it home for us. At one level, it's not nearly as bad of a description as Mordor. It's not even nearly as bad of a description as Isengard. There's still trees, there's still homes, there's still people living, there's still grass, there's still rivers. Meaning, again, when I say it's not nearly so bad, what I mean is it's not so horrific as the vomited entrails of Mordor. But it's far more realistic. And so on another level, for the same reason, it's much worse. It's much worse because it's our homes that it's happening to. And this is the important part. See, Tolkien is saying that if we make the sort of decisions that Saruman makes, then that's the next step for us. It was one of the saddest hours in their lives. And again, notice that the evil is described first by its effect on the land. Evil attacks the land. It attacks nature. We can see the effect of evil by what it does to the land. It was one of the saddest hours in their lives. The great chimney rose up before them. They saw the new mill in all its frowning and dirty ugliness. A great brick building straddling the stream, which it fouled with a steaming and stinking outflow. All along the Bywater Road, every tree had been felled. Even Sam's vision in the mirror had not prepared him for what they saw. The old grange on the west side had been knocked down, and in its place taken by rows of tarred sheds. All the chestnuts were gone. The banks and hedgerows were broken. Great wagons were standing in disorder in the field, beaten bare of grass. Bagshot Row was a yawning sand and gravel quarry. Bag End up beyond could not be seen for a clutter of large huts. These are our eyes, the hobbits are our eyes seeing the world, the anachronisms of Middle Earth that make it so interesting to us and that bring it home to us. Clutters of huts and fields beaten bare of grass are a common sight, even if the blasted landscapes of mortar are not. And so we can hear Sam say, "This is worse than Mordor," said Sam. "Much worse in a way, it comes home to you." This is the point. This brings it home to us. It comes home to you, as they say, because it is home, and you remember it all before it was ruined. And Frodo's response, "Yes, this is Mordor." Just as Tom Shippey points out about Isengard, we don't need Tom Shippey to interpret this for us, because Frodo says it outright. This is Mordor, just one of its works. Saruman was doing its work all the time, even when he thought he was working for himself. And the same with those Saruman tricked, like Lotho. Now, this is the work of Sauron. Now, again, I just want to make one aside. If we want to look at some of the rhetoric that brings it about, here's Farmer Cotton describing this scene. "It all began with Pimple, as we call him," said Farmer Cotton. Pimple's Frodo's adopted cousin. "Seems he wanted to own everything himself." Oh, there's that Wendell Berry agribusiness thing again, huh? "And then order other folk about. It soon came out that he already did own his good site more than was good for him, and he was always grabbing more, though where he got the money was a mystery. Mills and malt houses and inns and farms and leaf plantations. He'd already bought Sandyman's Mill before he came to Bag End, seemingly." And what you begin to realize is he has turned local, small-scale farming, where people consume the food grown on their own land, to large-scale farms, all owned by one person, who doesn't know the land he runs, and who raises the food for commercial export to faraway lands in the south, while starving the people who live on the land. This is as clear of a picture of agribusiness versus agrarianism as Wendell Berry paints for us, which is not a negative on Wendell Berry. I think I probably wouldn't have seen this as clearly in Tolkien if I hadn't sat and read Wendell Berry writing essays about it. But Tolkien understood this. By the way, I'm just finishing up a book on C.S. Lewis's ecology, which should be out in about 10 months. And I stumbled on this wonderful letter by C.S. Lewis. I don't even remember who he's writing the letter to. But in letter, he's describing a conversation with Tolkien. And the conversation he's having with Tolkien is Tolkien was pointing out to C.S. Lewis how dangerous he thought our international diet was. Tolkien is pointing out that we eat wheat from this place and meat from this place and potatoes from this place. And he said, we eat food from all over the world. We don't eat anything from our local region. And this disconnects us from our land. And then they go on in their conversation to talk about how in an older, healthier time, when we were more connected to the land around us, it would be natural to see nymphs and dryads in the woods and in the fountains, because we were more connected to the land. And these things were natural metaphors because they represented a real relationship with the earth. So I think Lewis and Tolkien, in having characters like Ents, or in Lewis's case, dryads, was not just an accidental or incidental or purely artistic decision, but that actually arose out of, oddly enough, the very modern issue of the importance of eating locally. That Lewis and Tolkien were consciously thinking about the importance of eating locally 50 years ago. And were writing the sort of literature that they thought would imaginatively support that sort of tradition. That's amazingly interesting to me. that they were really prophetic. Yeah.
Have you ever done anything with Chesterton and distributing something?
I have not, no, other than a few comments by Lewis to that. So if you go on and read this passage, you realize that, again, the hobbits of the Shire are growing hungry because the food is becoming used for export. So those are our three phases of evil, and it's just a little bit of a snapshot of them. I want to conclude, I think, with probably just a couple slides that at least hint at the theological underpinnings of this for Tolkien. There's not a time to really explore this in depth, but just one slide for 2 points to at least hint at this. If you read the Silmarillion, you can read Tolkien's beautiful creation account of Middle-earth, his creation myth for Middle-earth. He gives the name of the creator in two Elvish names, Eru and Ilúvatar. Eru in Elvish means the one. Ilúvatar in Elvish means the father of all. In Tolkien's creation myth, which he was conscious was different, in his myth of the fall, which he was conscious is different from our theology of the fall, but he felt like they're compatible. In his theology of the fall, the angels fall first, infect the earth with evil, and the earth is already infected with evil when humans and elves come. So his mythology of the fall is a little bit different. He was a devout in his Christian faith, and he was worried about to what extent he could create a world with a slightly different theology of fall. But this is his theology of the fall. And the fall occurs before elves and humans appear. And in one scene, one of the angelic beings who is still loyal to the Creator and is very intimately tied with the waters of the earth, his name is Ulmo, is grieving because the head fallen angel, the really evil angel, Sauron's chief, who's named Morgoth or Melkor, so the most powerful of the demonic fallen angels to whom Sauron is just a lieutenant, has ruined so much of the beauty of Middle-earth, and Ulmo says, "Seest thou not, Ilúvatar says, seest thou not how here in this little realm in the deeps of time, Melkor hath made war upon thy province, namely the waters of the earth. He hath bethought him of bitter cold and moderate, and devised heats and fires without restraint." So the point is that the most evil being in Middle Earth has the point of attacking the earth itself. Before there are any elves or humans on the scene to attack, he simply wants to destroy creation precisely because it is creation. To acknowledge that creation is God's work means if you want to attack God, you attack his creation. Of course, it's true the other way around. To attack God's creation is to wage war against God. You know, think of any artist and their painting. What would it be to an artist to go and throw paint or slash their painting up? Are you attacking a painting or are you attacking the painter? To wage war on creation is to wage war on the creator. Comment?
Yeah. There's one part about Morgoth and Sauron. Balin was to challenge Morgoth to the ring or to his power, defeat him. That thing would become the next devil.
If they were to use the ring to defeat Sauron, then the one who used the ring would become evil. And that's a really interesting point, but that would be another 45 minutes to explore. And the answer to that question gets to the nature of the ring. And for Tolkien, the ring does not simply represent power. It represents a very specific type of power. Melkor looked down upon Arda, and the beauty of the earth in its spring filled him the more with hate. He hates the creator, and so he hates the creation. Green things fell sick and rotted, and rivers were choked with weeds and slime, and fens were made rank and poisonous. Do you see how much all of this comes back to simply seeing the earth as creation? As the purposed work of a creator. Here, there's many, many passages in Tolkien's writing, but I felt like it'd be really sad to give a talk on Christian ecology and not at some point quote Wendell Berry. I'm simply going to claim at this point that if you read Tolkien's creation myth, that Wendell Berry's summary of the main points of biblical ecology, and particularly Genesis, are equally true of Tolkien's creation myth. The ecological teaching of the Bible is simply inescapable. God made the world because he wanted it made. He thinks the world is good, and he loves it. It is his world. He has never relinquished title to it, and he has never revoked the conditions bearing on his gift to us the use of it that oblige us to take excellent care of it. Those same points can be seen in Tolkien's creation story. One place you see them is when the angelic beings try to protect the elves from the ravages of Middle-earth by calling them into the west, into Valinor, to be protected. And Olmo, one of the wisest of the angels, said, "No, we can't do this. We should not do this. We ought not to do this. The elves should be left free to walk as they would in Middle-earth and with their gifts of skill to order all the lands and heal their hurts." So the purpose of God's children is to care for his creation and to heal the hurts caused by its wrong. To put it another way, as Christians, do you feel that Christians ought to work against sin? So let me ask, by working against sin, do we only work against some spiritual concept of sin and its eternal consequence, or ought we also work against the consequences of sin in this world? Do we only work now you're getting to one of the problems of some bad theologies. If you see that Christians are only called to work against the eternal consequences of sin, save people from hell, but not to work against the consequences of sin in this world, then you couldn't care less whether people are suffering, whether they're poor or oppressed people, right? Just save their souls and we've done our job. And we've also missed out on about 93% of the Bible, yeah.
But that supposes that distinction exists.
That absolutely supposes the distinction exists. That you can even distinguish between, say, these two things, right? Well, so if we agree that we ought to be working against the consequences of sin in the world, then think what Romans 8 says. The whole creation groans and suffers. The whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. And Paul goes on to talk about the impact of sin on creation. If we are called to work against the effects of sin in this world, can we ignore the fact that creation also suffers from sin? Ought we not have the same call that almost as the elves have to heal the hurts of the things of this world? Yavanna, also one of the wisest of the angelic beings, speaks of plants and animals, and she says, "All have their worth, and each contributes to the worth of others. Would that the trees might speak on behalf of all things that have roots and punish those that wrong them." This is where ants come from. So part of that passage, of course, it's just a little bit of fun background of where ants come from. But it also points out that in Tolkien's Middle-earth theology and ecology, that you can, again, morally wrong the earth, and that those who do so are deserving of punishment. But she also says that all have their worth, and if we actually expanded this and looked at a fuller quote, she says her spouse, Aule, actually makes the point that all have their worth even if men never came. In other words, the value of creation has value independent of its usefulness to us. God proclaimed creation good before we appeared on the scene. In fact, God called the plants and animals to be fruitful and to multiply and to fill the earth. And then he called us also to do the same thing. And so when we get to the end, what does that mean for us? Final two slides, and then we'll end. Look what Gandalf says is the heart of his mission. Gandalf, I think, the wisest being we meet in Middle-earth in The Lord of the Rings. I will say this, the rule of no realm is mine, neither of Gondor nor any other, great or small, but all worthy things that are in peril as the world now stands, those are my care. And for my part, I shall not wholly fail of my task, though Gondor should perish, though this human kingdom perish. If anything passes through this night that can still grow fair or bear fruit and flower again in days to come, for also I also am a steward, did you not know? Do you see how broadly Gandalf's care for creation extends? Everything of value on the earth, human and non-human, elvish and non-elvish, dwarvish and hobbitish and non-dwarvish and hobbitish, things that grow on the earth are worthy of being cared for. And if he can protect any of those, he's at least done something well. And of course, the converse is therefore true. If anything perishes, he's also failed to some degree. And he goes on a little bit later to make a really potent statement. Other evils there are that may come, for Sauron is himself but a servant or emissary. I just told you to whom he's a servant or emissary, Melkor or Morgoth. Yet it is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succor of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till. Wow. That's about as potent of a statement of healthy ecology as you can get. Our task is to make sure that those who live on the earth after us have clean earth to till. And, I read this so many times and interpreted this only in some metaphorical sense. And I think it's true in a metaphorical sense, but it also has just a face value truth to it. In fact, when you read Tolkien's story, you realize that time and time again, when he's looking for metaphors, he draws his metaphors from the soil and from the earth and for our care for the land. It's not an accident. It's because those things are important. Here's a statement of our goals, our roles as stewards. Uprooting the evil in the fields that we know so that those who live after may have clean earth to till. And finally, Frodo, near the start of his quest, says, I should like to save the Shire, if I could, though there have been times when I thought the inhabitants too stupid and dull for words. I feel that as long as the Shire lies behind, safe and comfortable, I shall find wandering more bearable. I shall know that somewhere there is a firm foothold, even if my feet cannot stand there again. And at the end he says again, I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved, but not for me. It must often be done so, Sam, when things are in danger. Someone has to give them up and lose them so that others may keep them. And there's two really important points I want to end with here. The first is that when Frodo's talking about saving the Shire here, my first sense, and probably what I read for dozens of years, is he's talking about saving the fellow hobbits, right? I want to save the Shire, meaning I want to save my fellow hobbits. And don't we tend to interpret that when we hear John 3:16, for God so loved the world, we mean, for God so loved only the humans who live on the world. Mm-hmm. But it says, for God so loved the world. I should like to save the Shire, even if I could, though there have been times when I thought the inhabitants too stupid and dull for words. As soon as you read that second phrase, you have to know that when Frodo says, I should like to save the Shire, he's speaking of something more than just its inhabitants. Now, he certainly includes its inhabitants. He wants to save his fellow hobbits. He loves his fellow hobbits. He wants to save them, but he wants to save the whole Shire. It's trees and forests. It's gardens. It's meadows. It's rivers. They are all worthy of his work on their behalf. They're all good and deserving of his efforts. I should like to save not only my fellow hobbits. Yes, I want to save them, but I want to save the whole Shire, including the hobbits. And I suppose also its good breweries and its inns and its culture and its strawberries. And then he goes on and says, I tried to save it. It's been saved. When things are in danger, someone has to give them up, lose them, so that others may keep them. It's not just a theistic vision here, but it's an explicitly Christian vision. Because the model of heroism that Frodo's giving us is the model of heroism that Christ gives us, where you are willing to give up your life for what you love, for who you love. And so Frodo is in this way, the hero, you know, the same heroic model as Christ. So a Christian ecology would be ecology modeled, an ecology that doesn't just recognize a creator God, but an ecology that recognized Christ as hero, which means taking the attitude of Christ as our attitude of a hero. And that's what Tolkien models for us. So I think I've gone about 5 minutes past an hour, and I have 3 hours to drive tonight, so... I can keep talking forever, but I don't want to call you. Thanks for your...